Thanks very much. Now, I realize I'm the last speaker of the morning, so I know everybody wants to have their coffee. And I'm very happy to speak here today because it was because of a talk a year and a half ago in this very room that I was attracted to come to UCSD from Stanford, because I looked around the room and I saw one of the biggest groups of very talented cancer and stem cell biologists that I'd ever seen before, and I feel the same way today. So thank you, Larry, for putting this together and the organizers. Now, I work on cancer stem cells because as a hematologist and oncologist, I'm constantly reminded that cancer is one of the biggest public health problems facing this country. So recently published SEER data showed that cancer has superseded heart disease as the leading cause of death, that there has been less than a 1.5% yearly decrease in cancer deaths in the last 10 years, despite a plethora of new treatment modalities and new diagnostic regimens, suggesting that we may be missing the boat. And I think that one of the cell types that we need to be targeting are cancer stem cells. Now, we all know about stem cells. We know they're primitive. We know they have the capacity to self-renew or make more of themselves and give rise to specialized tissues. We've heard about embryonic stem cell work today. That's very exciting. I've worked a lot on hematopoietic stem cells. I'm very interested in cancer stem cells. And I see this, you know, in the press, as a lot of you do, and I think it behooves us to work together to really rigorously test this hypothesis. Now, I see the cancer stem cell hypothesis as an evolutionary concept. Just like Darwin described the origin of species, we can insert cancer here. So if you think this is taken directly from the origin of the species, until recently the great majority of naturalists believed that, and Darwin wrote species here, but we can insert cancer, were immutable productions and had been separately created. However, some few naturalists, on the other hand, have believed that cancers undergo modification and that the existing forms of life are the descendants by true generation of pre-existing forms, or in other words, cancer stem cells. So this evolving idea of cancer stem cells suggests that cancers are a rare population of cells within the tumor that are the only cells capable of propagating the tumor. And these cells have a certain level of fitness to be able to survive in the host. They have homing and proliferative potential that's exaggerated, and of course self-renewal potential and limited differentiation potential. Now, I see this as a group effort. That's why it's important to do this work in La Jolla, because we do have the capacity to really work together. We've put together a La Jolla Cancer Stem Cell Working Group and would like to work with industry to rapidly translate our discoveries to the clinic. In humans, we have a lot of the cell surface markers that allow us to isolate these cells and prospectively identify cancer stem cells in hematopoietic malignancies. Now, I will focus today on myeloid leukemias and more specifically chronic myelogenous leukemia, because it was the first cancer to be associated with a chromosomal abnormality, and that's called the Philadelphia chromosome. It gives rise to a gene called BCR-ABL that we can use as our selectable marker. There's been over 40 years of experience using this as a paradigm for testing the cancer stem cell hypothesis. So first we looked at cancer stem cell survival in myeloid leukemia. This is work done together with David Traver and Irv Weissman's lab, as well as Sid Jaiswal. And in a microarray screen, it became apparent that CD47, or integrin-associated protein, was highly expressed by the progenitors. So that was one of the first genes that came up. And this gene makes cells impervious to phagocytosis by macrophages when overexpressed. The progenitors that were expanded in these myeloid transgenic mouse models of leukemia were the granulocyte macrophage progenitors. And it was these cells that had high-level expression, red being leukemic here, CD47 expression in the leukemic setting. And it was only the high-expressing CD47 cells that transplanted disease. Now, was this relevant to human disease? We've looked at human CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia, as it progresses from the relatively well-tolerated chronic phase through to accelerated phase and blast crisis. Seen here in blue, CD47 expression goes up in the progenitor populations and then stays on in the lineage-positive population. So clearly, cancer stem cells, or the population we think is enriched for the cancer stem cell population, has enhanced survival capacity. Does it proliferate? Well, we looked at those cells, the same phenotype of cells, in the marrow and blood of 100 patient samples from patients with CML, and we found again that it was the granulocyte macrophage population that was expanding with progression to blast crisis, which is the most advanced phase of disease. And it was actually this population that amplified BCR-ABL, which is the hallmark gene for chronic myelogenous leukemia. So we know that these granulocyte macrophage progenitors have a proliferative advantage. So we wondered, do they also self-renew? And we were working on a pathway that has been mentioned already this morning, the Wnt signaling pathway. And we know that this is a vital pathway for normal hematopoietic stem cell self-renewal. And the main mediator of this pathway is called beta-catenin. And in its non-phosphorylated state, it's able to translocate to the nucleus and turn on transcription of key target genes that are involved in self-renewal. Now, what we found using a Wnt reporter system is these granulocyte macrophage progenitors from blast crisis CML overexpressed or overutilized this Wnt signaling pathway. And when we put in this green fluorescent protein, they gave rise to large green colonies that had evidence of Wnt signaling pathway activation. So can we inhibit this pathway? We published a couple of years ago that we can with lentiviral vectors, but I don't think anybody's going to sign up for lentiviral vector treatment. We used Axin as the inhibitor. Yes, we could inhibit in vitro self-renewal capacity of these CML-GMP. But more recently, together with Dennis Carson and Ted Malinsky, as well as Wolfgang Residlo, we've been investigating a marine sponge-derived compound that looks very good in the in vitro replating assay as an in vitro surrogate of self-renewal, and it inhibits both the CML hematopoietic stem cells and granulocyte macrophage progenitors, as seen here, but does not seem to have an inhibitory effect at equal concentrations on the normal hematopoietic stem cells. Now, what I've talked about so far are in vitro surrogates for self-renewal, so we felt we had to be more rigorous, so we turned to an in vivo model. This involves lentiviral transduction with green fluorescence protein as well as luciferase, both genes having been cloned here at UCSD. Now, we do that for 24 to 48 hours, and we introduce the cells into a RAG2 gamma chain knockout mouse. So this mouse is TB and NK deficient. It is the mouse that has the highest levels of human engraftment reported, up to 70%, as published in Science a couple of years ago. And then we're able to image these cells using a highly sensitive system called the Xenogen system. Now, this is just an example of some of the data we get. So as I mentioned, in CML, we have an expansion of the myeloid progenitors seen here. They're 34 positive, 38 positive. We take those cells. We sort them using a FACS ARIA. We transplant them after transduction with the bioluminescent gene. And this actually says, warning, saturated luminescent image. We're getting very high levels of engraftment with these cells, up to 44%, actually. And it's these cells that express the selectable gene, BCR-ABL. So it suggests that the cancer stem cell population is enriched within the CD34-positive, 38-positive fraction. And when we hone in more specifically on that fraction, it's the granulocyte macrophage progenitors that make up 90% of the total that are transmitting disease. So here you see the GMP. They give rise to the bioluminescent signal. They're the ones that give rise to myeloid engraftment or leukemic engraftment in the host. And in fact, as the sine qua non for a stem cell, we have to show serial transplantation potential. And what we see here is that it's only the CML blast crisis GMP population, not the blasts, not the hematopoietic stem cells from CML, that have the capacity to serially transplant disease and give rise to BCR-ABL positive cells in the secondary recipients. So here's the highly engrafted mouse that got the CML blast crisis GMP in the secondary setting, and they're the ones that give rise to BCR-ABL signal. So recently, together with Jessica Novak and Larry Goldstein, we've started to look at human embryonic stem cells to see if we can build cancer stem cell models using a more experimentally amenable model. And the idea is to add the genes we think are involved in the genesis of cancer stem cells sequentially to see how many are necessary and sufficient to cause full carcinogenesis in our transplant models. So this just shows you the undifferentiated human embryonic stem cells. They lack CD34 and 38, but there is a small population of CD90 positive cells. We can transplant these cells after transduction with the luciferase GFP into the same RAG2 gamma chain knockout mice. They seem to engraft faster, so this is day 12. And we will be sacrificing these animals on Monday and looking for the extent of hematopoietic engraftment in the hematopoietic organs. So we think that we can utilize this in vivo system to actually drive hematopoietic differentiation. So the model is, for, at least for cancer stem cells and CML, that a lot of the initial hits occur at the stem cell level, but some of the final hits, including acquisition of beta-catenin, occur at a more committed progenitor level, and this actually inhibits the cells from differentiating properly, resulting in the accumulation of these blasts that we see in the marrow. So the idea is that we would be able to provide highly active anti-leukemic stem cell therapy to inhibit the proliferative potential, self-renewal potential, differentiation, and homing and survival capacity of these cells, and thereby provide more effective therapy for our patients who unfortunately succumb to cancer all too often. And what we'd really like to strive for is to remove the sword of Damocles from our patients. And I think a lot of you know this story, you know, that Dionysius the First was a tyrant who was annoyed by this rather obsequious Damocles. And so he suspended a sword over Damocles' head. And that's how a lot of my patients feel, this constant sense of peril. And I think that we can start to remove that by more effectively diagnosing and targeting their cancers. So I'd like to thank everybody for their attention.
Over here and then over here.
Wonderful talk, Adrian. Work from Freddy Rothke suggested that knockouts, beta-catenin knockout, has no phenotype in hematopoiesis. And a recent paper in Nature Immunology suggested overexpression of activation of the Wnt pathway basically exhausts stem cell system and not amplifying hematopoietic stem cells. So, but it's clear that the beta-catenin is activated in the case of leukemia. So would you think that that would argue in favor of progenitor population rather being activated, or the other factors that has to kick in addition to beta-catenin to actually make a full-blown tumor?
I think the latter is the case. So I think that in order to make a full-blown tumor, you have to have a number of events go on. It's not enough to have one hit. It's necessary but not sufficient in the case of CML to have BCR-ABL. But you need at least two other hits. CD47 is one of them. BCL2 is something that I didn't mention, but we've seen it in every single patient sample that has activated beta-catenin, and those events happen first. So the unfortunate thing with blast crisis CML is that they acquire beta-catenin in a cell that doesn't know how to turn it off. So, you know, committed progenitors don't normally overexpress beta-catenin because they're not a self-renewing population. Now, normal hematopoietic stem cells have a number of ways to turn off beta-catenin. They also have another self-renewal gene notch that they can use, BMI1, HOXB4. They have alternative pathways. So if you knock out beta-catenin, other pathways can take over. And I think that's been well established. So I think that you do need a number of hits to get back to your point. And I think when we build our cancer stem cell models, we'll end up adding a number of genes to try to recapitulate this level of disease.
A question back here. So in your human embryonic stem cell model, how are you treating the human embryonic stem cells before you collect the CD90 positive cells?
Well, they were taken directly out of culture and stained, and we have to do this very quickly because the cells tend to aggregate. And what we're finding is that we're going to have to keep everything warm for as long as possible because at 4 degrees the cells aggregate and they die quickly. So we use our standard hematopoietic stem cell staining protocol. We stain them with a stringent lineage panel for half an hour, followed by washing and then a 30-minute staining with this stem cell cocktail.
But these are undifferentiated?
These are undifferentiated. So this is the first set of experiments, and in the subsequent experiments, we're going to differentiate these cells on OP9 layers to the CD34 positive cell stage. That happens starting at day 3 and usually peaks by day 7 according to published data. And then we'll transduce these cells with BCR-ABL and other genes that we know are important for the pathogenesis of this disease in particular.
Thank you.
One last question. No? Yes? Yeah, I thought you had your hand up. I forgot.
When you were looking at the sort of alternate distribution of the injected human embryonic stem cells, it looked like there might have like a node lit up, but it also looked like there might be a lot of liver accumulation.
Right.
think you're observing kind of a filtration pathway of just any sort of foreign agent.
Now, what I should mention is we do intrahepatic injections in newborn mice because we're taking advantage of the rich cytokine milieu within the liver, within the nascent liver, and that's actually the most active area of hematopoiesis within 3 days of birth. So we're trying to drive these cells toward hematopoietic differentiation by using the liver to its fullest capacity.
Good.